This is the Paula Gordon Show. I am Paula. Bill Russell and I are in Los Angeles with Dr. Jared Diamond. In your Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, you simply altered the way I look at most everything. Thank you. I guess I needed that. One of the things that got very clear for me is that as a species, we are both challenged, but we should not be overwhelmed that there is good news as well as bad news. I have, all of my life, being born after the Second War, I have heard about genocide. Genocide then became more real to me as I came to understand what happened in the Americas with the Native American people. But I had not thought of our species as being profiting from genocide until I began to think about the Neanderthals, which you helped me to think about. As a species, how are we doing? Don't we have some real challenges on this planet as a species?
Yes, we have challenges, which include, of course, genocide. I pick up the newspaper this morning and I read about what the Serbs are doing in Albania. I, too, having been born before the Second World War, I grew up to think of the Nazi genocide as unique. And yes, in certain respects, it was unique in its scale, in its technology. But in another way, it was banal. Genocide has been far more, it's been virtually routine in human history. And the failure to recognize that is what permits it to crop up again and again. Because most of us, most people, believe that genocide is something that only Nazis do. Mm-hmm. It's not something like that nice people like you and I do. But one of the main messages of human history is that genocide is something that nice people have done under exceptional circumstances, but circumstances that have occurred to lots of people.
One of the outstanding characteristics of humans seems to be our ability to rationalize, and that seems to apply specifically to that particular. I mean, we have a universal morality that we attend to when it's convenient, I guess, and then sometimes when it's inconvenient, but we also seem to have the ability to rationalize our way past that.
Yeah.
How do we do that? We just lie to ourselves?
Well, most humans make a distinction between us and them. There's our own people, our kin, our ethnic group with whom we identify and to whom we have obligations. And then there are those people over there about whom we don't know much, and they're unspeakable and they do dreadful things and they're like animals. This, of course, was the basis of the Nazi genocide. Nazis said explicitly, Jews are subhuman, gypsies are subhuman. Serbs certainly hold low opinions of Albanians. But again, this is something that I have perspective on in my work in New Guinea. New Guinea has 1,000 different tribes. And initially, to me, they looked pretty similar. Physically, they're fairly similar, and they were all using stone tools until recently. And yet, when I talk with New Guineans, people who are good friends of mine, and I find out about the genocidal massacres in which they've participated, they'll tell me, oh, those people over in the next valley who you think look like us, they are, in fact, unspeakable brutes. They've done these dreadful things to us. And so, when I was a teenager, I was on a raid that tried to wipe them out completely, and it's one of the great disappointments of my life that I was not able to kill the man who killed my father, and I'm still hoping to do that someday.
So revenge is a driver on perhaps many levels. And as you say this, I'm thinking, I go back to the Neanderthals. If other is bad, it is okay to destroy it.
Exactly. Exactly. On the one hand, in order to live together in societies, we have to have strong inhibitions about killing another human. And on the other hand, we have to have ways of overcoming those inhibitions if we are to justify killing the people next door.
Which brings us to kleptocracies and religion, doesn't it?
If you wish to put kleptocracy and religion in the same sentence, yes, it does.
Well, it's somewhat provocative, but help those who are listening with us to know why I did that.
A chapter in Guns, Germs, and Steel was concerned with the origin of complex political institutions, government, but the same chapter was also concerned with the origins of organized religion, and the word kleptocracy figured in the chapter. Governments, all governments...
That's like kleptomania. That is to take by taking. kleptocracy.
Right. Kleptocracy, analogous to democracy, means a government whose function is for the leaders to steal from the masses. And all governments practice transfer of wealth. The leaders of most governments were either rich to begin with, or else they became wealthy in the course of being governmental leaders. So a big problem in human history is, why did the masses tolerate this? The development of complex political institutions is something that went along with the rise of food production. But to come back to your comment, kleptocracy and religion. All people throughout the world have religion in the sense of what you could call supernatural beliefs, beliefs about spirits, gods, origin myths, but only certain peoples have organized religions with standardized temples, religion linked to morality. And organized religion seems to have arisen with the rise of states and empires about, say, 5,000 years ago. Organized religion arose as a handmaiden of empires to justify why you should obey the king and not kill the other people in your own society, but be ready to serve in an army and exterminate the people next door.
This is an appeal to a greater force.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's almost by analogy, this is a greater force in the local society, in our society, and this greatness, the leadership, is certified, authenticated by the affiliation with some unseen greater force.
I, the high priest, authenticate that this king of yours really is a sun god derived from the gods, and you should obey him. In addition, I authenticate that you should be nice to the other people in our own society. And above all, I absolve you when you go and do terrible tortures to the people next door that we would not tolerate here at home.
I hear you say, and was puzzled as I read through the book, are you telling me that hierarchy is inevitable in the species? Because I see in other places that people are trying models that are not hierarchical, and maybe that is not natural. But this argument of hierarchy, at least with our species as we developed, sounds like we're stuck with that.
Let's avoid using the word inevitable because it clouds people's minds. Let's instead ask simply what happened. And what did happen is that every single society in the world, more complex than a hunter-gatherer society, is hierarchical. The most democratic, the most egalitarian societies in the world are small hunter-gatherer bands. And every society beyond that, chiefdom societies, states, empires, are hierarchical. Yes, there are efforts in many modern societies to become less hierarchical, but the fact is that all modern societies have enormously greater discrepancies in power and wealth than does any hunter-gatherer society.
Going back to the agricultural revolution, you suggest that we made a de facto decision to opt for number as opposed to quality, that by adopting agriculture, the quality of the individual's life didn't improve, and in fact, for some time, diminished, but that it allowed us to have more people, and that we're still dealing with the consequences of that.
Basically, yes. I would not call it a de facto decision because it, again,
decision suggests
that it was conscious. What one can say is that agriculture, food production, herding, lets you support more people per square mile than does the hunter-gatherer lifestyle, because in a wheat field, more of the plants are edible than out in a forest. And in a pasture, more of the animals are edible than out in a forest. So the population densities of farmers are on the average roughly 100 times the population densities of hunter-gatherers. That means then that even if farmers are sicker and smaller and they don't live as long, just by sheer force of numbers, the farmers are going to be able to push hunter-gatherers out of land suitable for farming, and that is what has happened throughout history ever since the origins of farming. All over the planet, wherever the farmers had access. Now, there are conspicuous exceptions. Here, where we are sitting in California, California is now one of the breadbaskets of the United States, of the world. Interestingly, there was no agriculture in Native American California. And the reason is not that California was unsuitable for agriculture. It's great for farming and herding. It's that there were ecological barriers that prevented the arrival, the transfer of Native American crops, which had reached Arizona as far as Arizona, and as far as the Colorado River. The desert then was an ecological barrier through which beans, squash, and corn could not spread.
Back to that geography thing.
Geography, and again, Native Americans in California. Hunter-gatherers had a very productive lifestyle with oak trees from which they made flour, so that even if they heard of beans, squash, and corn out there, they had a good enough lifestyle.
This is Jared Diamond. He is a physiologist. He has spent many years in New Guinea, looking at us as we were and as we have become, and comparing and contrasting. He's also the winner of the Pulitzer Prize with Gun, Germs, and Steel. We're going to be back in just a moment. Bill Russell and I, we are with Dr. Diamond in Los Angeles. Please stay with us.